You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
How do we provide energy in the next few decades? What kind of energy mix will we have? Now, we already had this report released, we know this, in London, but today we're talking about how the European Union is going to react in this volatile world. So we're having Mr. Šefčovič from the European Commission to join us, as well as others, who I will introduce to you later. But let's get quickly. We have 2 hours. I'd like to have a very, very good debate with you and with the panelists. So let us start with the report, with Fatih Birol of the International Energy Agency. Fatih.
Mr. Vice President, ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, a very good morning to all of you. It's a great pleasure to come back to another event organized by Friends of Europe. As Chris just mentioned, we released our report 2 days ago in London to international press, and we are, my colleagues and myself, presenting the report in different capitals to the different audiences. Our report is a lot of things to cover, to discuss, but I would like to focus on two issues, which are, I believe, the preoccupations of almost everybody in the global energy scene. The first one is low energy prices. What are the reasons? Are they going to be with us for longer? And if they stay lower, what are the implications of that? Are they good news or bad news? This is one issue I want to deal with. The second issue I would like to deal with is the Paris, the climate change, the COP meeting, the role of energy sector towards Paris, and the implications of Paris for the energy sector. And this is based on these issues, it will be based on our report, and I am very happy that I am accompanied with my colleague, Mrs. Laura Kozi, who, by the way, I understood recently, got a strong promotion at the IEA. So, congratulations, Laura. Now, let me take you through to some of our findings and try to set the scene. This year, we have seen very low energy prices. Oil, everybody knows, but gas as well. If you look at, for example, the Asian LNG, which is considered to be the highest gas prices, from $20, it went down to $7, a big drop there. And the message and issue that I would like to highlight is this year, oil investments declined by more than 20% globally. And more importantly, maybe, we expect next year this decline of investment will continue. And it is the first time since 30 years we see oil investment declining in 2 consecutive years. So this will have implications for the markets we feel in the next years to come. Coal prices, about $50. We have not seen such low coal prices for the last few decades, mainly as a result of China, coal demand slowing down. So we are in a low energy price environment, and we wanted to look what does it mean for the future. The second issue I mentioned to you is Paris. And before Paris, we think we are getting some green lights in some of the parts of the energy sector, but more importantly, we see that there is a strong political momentum building before Paris. European Union has been the champion of fighting against climate change, but recently two other major powers, US and China, are pushing the policy very strongly, and we have a very strong political momentum, and more than 150 countries now put pledges that they are going to address this issue in Paris and beyond. Renewables are growing very strongly. Another good news before Paris, last year, about half of all new power plants came on stream were renewables. Other half was coal plus oil plus gas plus nuclear put together 50%, and renewables were 50% last year. Subsidies, fossil fuel subsidies, a major problem. In my view, the public enemy number one of renewables and energy efficiency, about $500 billion. Some countries, such as India, Indonesia, are taking the opportunity of low oil prices. They are reforming them. It is a good news. So there are different signs in the energy sector, from the prices, from the climate, from renewables. We analyze which of them are cyclical changes, which are structural changes, which will give us some hint for some important long-term decisions. Now, when we look at the global energy demand growth, we see that the energy demand in the so-called advanced economies in Europe, US, Japan is going to decline. And this is an extremely good news, because on one hand, the economy will grow, continue to grow, perhaps at a slower pace than we have been seeing in the last couple of decades, but energy demand will be declining, and this is mainly as a result of us in these countries using energy more efficiently. Some parts of the world are pushing the demand growth, and one region I would like to bring to your attention, which receives, in my view, unfortunately, little attention despite the importance, is Southeast Asia. The countries, the Indonesia, Thailand, and Vietnam, their energy demand is growing very, very strongly, and it is the only region in the world where the share of coal is steadily increasing. And bulk of the coal-fired power plants built there are subcritical coal-fired power plants, which will be with us for many years to come. Of course, the China and India are growing, and the news is India, we believe, is going to be the engine of global energy demand growth in the next years to come. And with a rather moderate pace, the amount of energy India will use in two decades of time will be equal to the United States. And even there, the Indian energy, Indian citizens' energy consumption per capita will be only 40% of the global average. So India is coming as a major driver of the energy demand growth. Now, we at the IEA look at all the technologies and at their technological developments in terms of cost very closely. And we are very happy to see that some clean energy technologies' cost is going down as a result of government support. Renewables, and here a big congratulations to our European colleagues. They were the driver of the renewable energies many years, and they played a very important role on the effect of learning by doing. So as a result of that, we have seen, and we will see, renewable energies and some efficient technologies to be cheaper in the future compared to today. But unlike those, we expect the oil and gas production on average, the cost of bringing them under the ground will increase because despite also the efficiency improvement in the upstream technologies, more and more oil and gas will come from more complex fields, geologically complex fields, which are going to push the prices up. And therefore, we believe it is one of the reasons we think the oil and gas prices may need to be higher in the future than today. But the message is the balance in terms of cost balance between the technologies, the efficient and clean energy technologies are gradually moving in the right direction. Now, one question that we all of us are facing today, the U.S. shale oil, which is the main driver of the oil price collapse today. How resilient they are to the low oil prices. We look at a field-by-field basis, talking with a lot of operators, companies. Our view is that if the prices will remain at current levels in the next 5 years, U.S. oil production will decline almost 3 million barrels per day compared to today. So in the 5 years, U.S. oil production will decline about 3 million barrels per day if the prices remain at these levels. We think it is very important to note that the bulk of those deposits, shale oil deposits, would make commercial sense if the prices are between $60 and $70 in the United States. Of course, U.S. is not the only driver of the production growth. The second one was a big driver was Iraq. And when we look at the Iraq today, which we did, we revised down our oil production growth from Iraq mainly as a result of the difficulties the Iraqi government is in terms of having enough cash to pay the operators and for the investments as a result of security spending. And we expect that demand to continue to grow at a lower but a healthy pace. As a result of those, our belief as IEA, oil prices will gradually increase and the markets may balance around 2020, around $80 per barrel. This is the bracket that we are looking into. Of course, this is $80 and gradually increases our view in the next few years to come. And there is another school of thought. Some colleagues think that we have now a new normal $50 oil price for a very long time. So therefore, we thought we should look into that. First, what would it take to have a $50 world for many years? And second, if it happens, is that good news or not for everybody? So we look at these two issues. And our analysis show that in order to have a $50 world for 10 years or beyond, we need many things to happen, but two things are very important. One, the non-OPEC countries such as US, Russia, Brazil, Africa will be able to produce oil profitably at $50, which we think is very unlikely. This is the one thing needs to happen. Second, in order to have a $50 world, we need to see a stable Middle East and stable production growth from key Middle East countries, including Iraq, which we also think is rather unlikely. But these things to happen. We may be right or wrong, but this is our analysis. And if the prices remain low, of course, it is a good news at the first sight to the importers, oil importers, because they will pay less money. The EU or the China, India, many countries in Asia will pay. This is a good news from economic benefit point of view. No problem. But if the prices stay low many, many years, the only area in the world which can produce oil and make money is Middle East, because it's very cheap to produce oil there compared to Brazil or United States or Russia and elsewhere. This means our reliance, world's reliance on Middle East will increase substantially. Today, about 50%, half of the oil exported worldwide comes from Middle East, and in such a $50 world, this will jump to more than two-thirds. And given the situation some countries are in Middle East, we think from an oil security point of view, this may not be a good news that the bulk of the, a big chunk of the global oil export coming from a region which is in a turmoil. There are many diplomats in this room, they know much better than me, that the problems we face in Middle East today may not be solved tomorrow. Some of them may be structural issues which will be with us some years to come. So therefore, we should think of the $50 world's implications for the oil security as well. The second issue with the low oil prices for a longer time is on the efficiency front. In the last few years, we have seen a major push for energy efficiency, once again, the Europe being one of the champions here, but also followed by China, followed by United States and others. And one of the drivers of energy efficiency push, if not the most important one, was the saving money, cost savings. And if the prices remain very long term, so the pressure on energy efficiency policies may be weaker. And second, renewable energies, I will show you in a moment, making strong inroads. And here, government supports play a very important role. We hope to see that the government continue to support renewables, but there may be some resilience in different corners in a low oil price environment to support, continue to support renewable energies. So when we look at all the factors, as a result of lower revenues coming to some key producers as a result of low prices, and the lower prices will boost the oil demand growth, as we have seen in the United States and it's in other parts of the world. In the last 1.5 years, number of SUV sales jumped strongly. The oil demand will go up, and as a result of that, we believe, as IEA, $50 oil price very long time is not a likely scenario. Moving to gas from here and focusing on Asia. But before focusing on Asia, I should tell you that we see in the gas trade, international gas trade, a development which is, I believe, a good news. Namely, today the share of pipeline versus LNG in the gas trade is about 50% versus 50%, and this will change in favor of LNG worldwide. There are many reasons behind that, but the new sources coming, many countries are pushing LNG as a source of diversification and bringing flexibility and enhancing therefore their security. And as a result of that, we see LNG is going to grow significantly worldwide. Asia will be one of the areas that we see LNG to grow for the following reason. Today in Asia, when we look at it, demand and supply is production is more or less the same. But in the future, we expect demand to grow strongly and some growth coming from the production, from the supply side. And there will be a gap about 400 BCM. And this is, and this 400 BCM is a chunk of opportunity for many exporters, producers today, ranging from Australia to Russia, from Russia to United States, from US to Africa. Companies, countries want to have their share in this 400 BCM. Big opportunity, and all eyes are there, in addition, of course, to the European markets, which is an established one. In this growing LNG markets in Asia, however, there are two uncertainties, since many companies are here, I wanted to highlight in this 400 BCM. The one of them is on the production side. Of the production growth in Asia, big chunk comes from the Chinese unconventional gas growth, the shale gas. Our numbers, expectations are much lower than the resources and somehow more modest than the official estimates, but still a big chunk. But there are important question marks whether or not even that production growth can happen because of geological, regulatory, and market challenges there. So production may be lower, therefore the imports may be higher. The second uncertainty is on the demand side. Gas, natural gas in Asia is facing two important challenges. One, on the side of coal, which is much cheaper, and in many countries there are not environmental regulations to slow down the building of new inefficient coal-fired power plants. Again, in Southeast Asia, capacity will grow in 20 years, one Japan plus one Korea equivalent, and the big chunk of it will be inefficient coal-fired power plants. And as we all know, most of you know much better than me, 1 ton of CO2 going to atmosphere from Southeast Asia or from Brussels or from Detroit has the same value for all of us. So there is a pressure on gas from that coal angle. And the second pressure comes from renewables. Now, gas has to compete with the Indian solar program, with the Chinese wind program, which is supported by the governments. So gas may be squeezed there if the measures are not taken, including the measures to address the local pollution in the cities. And, of course, the prices will be an important aspect of the game. Now, one important finding of our study is a news about China, which I am very interested in. Friends of Europe and other colleagues invited us since many years to Brussels, and we are always very happy to come. Some of the colleagues follow our work may remember. In 2007, we said at that time, that China will soon be a coal importer. At that time, it was impossible to believe a country like China, but they became a coal importer. It changed the entire coal and therefore the gas global picture. Now, this year, we look at China again, and our judgment is that we are approaching the end of the single largest energy demand growth story of the energy history. China is slowing down. China energy demand growth is slowing down, and we have seen the first numbers 2014 and 15 that this is happening. When you look at the last decades or so, the energy demand and the economy in China increase in parallel. A very close iron relationship between those. But when we look at the future, while the economy will grow even slower than in the past, we expect the energy demand growth will slow down significantly, with implications for all of us. And why it is happening? At least two reasons. One, Chinese government is the government among the emerging countries which pushes hardest the energy efficiency button throughout the energy sector. This is number one. Second, Chinese government is changing the economic structure of China, moving from an industry-heavy manufactured-based economy to a lighter economy, and therefore this is reflected in the slowing down of energy demand growth. This is the first change about China which will affect all of us. The second change is also, I think, in China very important. When we look at the past, about 2015 as of today, you see only two colors, basically. Brown, which is coal, followed by oil. But now, Chinese energy mix is becoming more colorful. It means energy mix is changing. We get growing gas, nuclear. 4 out of 10 new nuclear power plants in the world today or under construction is in China. And renewable energies. China is by far, in terms of the volumes, number one country in the world in terms of bringing new nuclear capacity. So China is not only slowing down the energy demand growth, but at the same time providing new colors, diversification in the energy mix, which helps to slowing down of the emissions growth. But still, of course, China remains the number one country with the highest emissions, but a very strong policy to address them. Every year in the World Energy Outlook, we focus on a country in depth, and this year it is India. In 2 weeks of time, I will announce the Indian results with the Indian ministers in New Delhi. But just to give you a flavor of that, we think, first of all, India is moving to the center stage of world energy system. There are many drivers under strong economic growth. 240 million people have no access to electricity out of this 1.2 billion people plus you, about 240 million are in India. And in a very short period of time, 600 million people will gain electricity in India, a huge growth. And Modi government has a very strong Make in India program, which makes India a manufacturing base. And as of today, in fact, India is moving to be the number one steel producer of the world, number one cement producer of the world. This means energy. So when we look at the numbers, we see India will be the first country with the highest coal consumption growth coming. India will be the, again, number one country in terms of oil demand growth coming. But at the same time, India will be the country where the 20% of the new PV installation coming, and as such will be an important player in the global energy markets and the environmental issues. Moving to power sector, which is the heart of the energy sector, we see an important change here. Today, coal is by far, coal has by far the largest share in the global power generation mix, but we expect important changes to happen. Oil already has a very small share, except for Middle East in terms of electricity generation, it goes back even more. Nuclear coming mainly from the Asian countries, China, India, Korea, some in Japan, restart of some of the nuclear power plants. Gas is growing, is in many cases a base load technology, but also supporting the renewable growth. Coal is growing slightly, but losing substantial market share. over 40% today to close to 30% in 2040 with the current policies in place. But the biggest, for me, the most important message is on the renewables. First of all, two messages about renewables. One, renewables are becoming the number one fuel, overtaking coal. This is, I think, a very good news. And second, to understand the dynamics, when you look at the past few years, a big chunk of the renewable energy growth came from hydropower, and now this is changing. Wind is going to be the driver, in absolute terms, growth in renewables, followed by solar and others. And renewables, when we look at the next two decades, about $1 invested in the total electricity generation, 60 cents go for renewable investments. 60 cents for renewable investments and 40 cents for all the other power generation technologies put together. As such, I think it is now time to say that renewables are not anymore a niche technology, but renewables are a mainstream fuel as of now. Now, one point on efficiency, and with the climate change, I will finish our words. Now, efficiency is an area, as I was, I had the opportunity and the privilege to talk with Mr. Vice President as the new IEA head. It is one of my aims is to make International Energy Agency the international voice of energy efficiency, where the best practices policies come and will be the central banker of the energy efficiency policies to exchange with not only our member countries, but perhaps more importantly, the emerging countries which are very keen to push the energy efficiency policies. And of course, European Commission pushing this agenda since long time will be a source of inspiration for us for many years to come. So we said, we are, as IEA and many others, always talk about energy efficiency is very important, the first fuel and others. How many percent of the global energy consumption is covered or subject to energy efficiency policies? We look at it. And in 2005, about 15% of the global energy consumption was covered by the mandatory efficiency policies on refrigerators, on cars, and so on. And as of today, the number went to higher than 25%, I think 27% now, and 27%, a big push, and there are two factors behind that push, when you look at the size of the factors. One is the China pushing the energy efficiency policies, and second, high energy prices in the last few years gave an additional boost to the energy efficiency policies. When we look at the future, we expect that it will going to increase further, even in a world where the policies are continuing as they are today. And here, again, Europe has a lot of success, especially on the appliances, electric appliances, cars, and I hope to see the same achievement of cars efficiency on the trucks sometime soon, but efficiency policies are definitely very important to address costs issues, competitiveness issues, as well as the climate change issues. Let me move to the climate change part. So we, as the IEA, we are, as some of you may know, and we will be very active in the climate change debate. Why? Very simple. Very, very simple. Two-thirds of the emissions causing climate change come from the energy sector. We have a big responsibility on our shoulders to find a solution to climate change problem. At the same time, I wanted to tell you that the energy is, in fact, a very good thing. So energy shouldn't be seen as a bad thing, a problematic issue. It's energy makes life easier, more comfortable, more productive, easier. But the problem is to reduce the negative implications of using energy. And climate change is one of them. And today I am extremely happy that more than 150 countries show political will to address the climate change problem through putting pledges on the table. Now, we look at those pledges one by one of all the countries. What does it mean for climate? What does it mean for the energy sector? For climate, it means if all these pledges are implemented, if all of them are implemented, the temperature increase will be about 2.7 degrees Celsius. It is higher than the scientists told us the world can bear, the world can take it. And the difference between 2 degrees and 2.7 degrees is not something that you just take your jacket off and add up the world. It is much more serious than that. It will have catastrophic implications for all of us. And we also look that the most of those pledges are based on energy policies to be realized. And when I say energy policies, two of them come at the top, improving energy efficiency and increasing the share of renewable energies in the country's energy mix. I will just give you one result of our study to show what does it mean if those pledges are implemented and finish our presentation. Electricity generation worldwide was increasing, which is a very good news once again. We need electricity. We need modernization. We need to use electricity efficiently, but we need especially the world, the parts of the world which needs it a lot. There is nothing wrong with producing electricity, but the problem was there is a strong correlation between the electricity generation and the emissions coming from electricity generation. This is the problem. And if these pledges are implemented, this close relationship between electricity generation and the emissions will change, even though the electricity generation will continue to increase, emissions remain flat. So we see a decoupling of the electricity generation and the emissions mainly as a result of renewables share increasing as a result of the pledges. So this close relationship between electricity generation ends up with a divorce, a happy divorce between the electricity generation and the CO2 emissions, which is a good news for all of us. Now, I would like to finish our presentation and very much looking forward to hear the views of Mr. Vice President and my colleagues in the panel, but to tell you that the low prices of energy may be good in the beginning to have some economic benefits for the importers, but it may create some challenges in terms of oil security and the energy transition in the future. And oil security, I believe, still a very important issue, and it will be a grave mistake to index our oil security policies to the changes in the oil prices. Oil prices go down, some may think oil security is not important. Go up, it is very important. So I think it will not be indexed to the changes in oil prices, it must be a strategic issue. Indian energy needs are growing very strongly, and it is, I think, in the interest of all of us to support India's political push for clean and efficient technologies. China changing. It is coming to the end of the boom of energy demand growth, although China still becomes the largest country in terms of energy consumption, but the pace of the growth is changing, and India is overtaking as the engine of the energy demand growth. We, as the IEA, would very much like to see, first of all, an agreement in Paris. Second, in that agreement, these pledges are cemented and even make stronger. Third, energy is at the core of that agreement, as the 2/3 of the emissions come from them. Fourth and finally, we would like to see a clear roadmap after Paris for the energy sector. And the energy industry needs to get a signal from Paris for the next energy investments to be made. And finally, when we look at the energy security and environmental challenges globally, we think the international cooperation on energy is extremely important, and IEA is ready to fulfill its role in that context. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Fatih Birol, thank you very much. I think it's a throwing down of the gauntlet to those 150-some governments that are going to be meeting in Paris in 18 days. It's not far away. If our other panelists could please join us. I think you also tipped your hat to the European Union for its policies of wanting to cut carbon emissions. It's a bit of a challenge, too, suggesting that you got to stay on track and show the leadership that the world needs in this very decisive moment, really, for the planet. And it's interesting also that the International Energy Agency, in its conclusions, finds extremely important what goes on in Paris next month. Let's go to the European Commission now, Maruša Šefčovič. If you could discuss with us, you've been traveling Europe now. With Denmark this week, it's been 22 yeah. countries, that you've been scanning what is possible. You've been on the ground hearing what people are saying, what their concerns are. And we got a sneak peek from Reuters this week about what sort of projects could be in line with this energy union. Now, how does the energy union, it's a bit of a difficult birth, right, actually. It's going to be over the next few years, but you are going to give the first State of Energy Union message next week. Maybe we might get a bit of a sneak peek of that. Maruša.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Nick. First, good morning to everyone. I really would like to thank the Friends of Europe, Natalie, for organizing this event at such an appropriate time in such a beautiful setting. And I really would like to thank Fatih for his excellent presentation and for the great work. He's working already for years. Before he became head of the agency, he was for many years chief economist. And as I told him this morning, he combines that unique features of being expert, having this deep expert knowledge, but also being a leader of the agency, which is reflecting very well all these new tendencies and trends we see on the global stage. And therefore, for me, it's really a privilege to participate in this panel, because I know the lady and the gentleman who are going to share with you the insights, and I'm sure that this would be a very interesting debate. But reacting to some of the issues which have been highlighted by Fatih, but also the questions presented by Nick, I think that this just proves that how much we in the institutions like the European Commission benefit from the close collaborations with the agencies, like the agency which is represented here by Fatih. Because we want to work with real numbers. We want to work with precise data. We want to work with a good forecast. Because when we present our legislative proposals, we want to make sure they are up to date, that they are setting the framework for the future, and that we are actually starting from the well-established date. Therefore, the World Energy Outlook, which was presented by Fatih, all these new global trends and tendencies would be very crucial for the work of the European Commission, and I'm sure the European Parliament and our member states when we'll be putting this energy union framework into practice. At the same time, I think what was very important to see in the presentation of Fatih was the fact that we cannot think that we can build the energy union in some kind of vacuum. When I'm traveling across the Europe, one point I always want to highlight that what I do is actually I campaign for this idea. Because I'm absolutely convinced that we cannot build the energy union here in Brussels. We need to build it in our member states, in our cities, in our factories. But now I think we also have to add that we cannot build it in a vacuum and believe that we can be somehow isolated from the developments in our region, but also from the global tendencies and global evolutions we see in the energy and climate arena. Therefore, I think that timing of that report, just a couple of weeks before COP21, just 1 week before I will present the first State of the Energy Union, was excellent, and I very much enjoyed reading the report and also following the Fatih's presentation. So if you allow me, for the sake of time, to freeze for a moment the picture on the most important findings of the report and the implications for the Energy Union and the European Union. At first, I think what is very important, and therefore I was very much encouraged, especially by the last slides, that we can do this decoupling on the global scale. Fatih called it happy divorce. We call it decoupling between the energy productions and CO2 emissions. And I think that we've proven in Europe that it's possible. I think we've been the first who clearly demonstrated that you can grow and you can cut your CO2 emissions. Because since 1990, the European economy grew by 45%, but at the same time, we managed to cut the greenhouse gas emissions by 19%. And now we see that this approach, this method, responsible governing is kind of being embraced by more and more global partners, and that we would see that this would be the tendency for the future, which is very encouraging. And therefore, I think it's very important for us in Europe to be sure that we would stick to our ambitious climate policies. I'm pretty confident that if it comes to the 2020 targets, that we would overachieve them. That's the impression I have when I travel across the EU member states, where vast majority of them is already overachieving the goals for 2020. But we cannot slow down. And therefore, we will be coming with very ambitious proposals, one you have already seen this summer, on how to reform the emissions trading system for post-2020 period to reflect our new climate goals for 2030, but also the set of the proposals we would make in 2030, especially for the non-ETS, for the transport sector, and for the energy efficiency. And of course, we also agree with Fatih that renewables and renewable energy is a game changer. And as you know, as our president stated it, we just don't want to observe this process. We want to remain global leader in renewables. Therefore, we set these very ambitious targets that we will have 27% of renewables in our energy mix by 2030, because we see it not only as a responsible governing, we see that in the renewables there is very strong business case. We see how the renewable industry is growing in Europe. Already now we have 1.1 million people working in this industry with the annual turnover of 129 billion of euros. But if you take a little bit larger picture, so we see that the green industry was actually the one which was booming, which was growing even during the last year of the crisis. And currently, there is more than 4.2 million people actually working in the green industries. And when I visit the companies, the labs in our member states, you are very often just overwhelmed by that creativity, by that innovation, by the new patents which are being made, and we just need a proper regulatory framework to make it to the global stage and to become the global, well-respected innovations and the technologies. Therefore, I think the point the Fatih was making about the appropriate network, about the appropriate price signals, about appropriate mechanism being brought into the all equation, I think are very important. I hope that somebody is doing a good vacuuming in the back there, but I will stick to the I will stick to the presentation of what we are going to focus on in the future. I think it was quite clear that if it comes to the progress in the next year, that research and innovation will play a very key role. And therefore, the new focus the IEA is going to put on the research and innovation, I think goes very well in the same direction as what we are proposing in the European Commission. We just adopted the new SET plan, the SET, you know, that's abbreviation for Strategy for Energy Technologies, in September of this year, and we just see it as the first step to the more global technological energy-oriented strategy which we would like to present in the September of the next year, and which would really promote all these technological, disruptive technologies we need to put in place to make sure that this energy transition will take place in the accelerated way than we have seen it until today. I very much appreciate the important report's conclusions on the energy efficiency. We in Europe believe that energy efficiency should be the first fuel. That before we take any decision in the future on major infrastructural projects, we should at first measure how much energy we can save. Saved energy is the cleanest energy, and how we can proceed in that respect, not only in our city, not only in our country, but region-wise and Europe-wide. And therefore, I think and I hope that by these very convincing numbers on how important energy labeling is, what kind of benefits the eco-design is bringing, how important it is to increase energy efficiency of our buildings and how much we benefit for better fuel efficiency of our transport. We put aside all that discussion of European policies which we have seen in some of the pre-election campaigns where some of the circles have been asking why the EU is taking such an interest in our boilers. Because it matters, because it saves a lot of energy, because thanks to the energy labeling, we have said we will save by 2020 as much energy as is consumed by such a big country like Italy. So I hope that also now these scientific conclusions will just prove that this is important and that we need to devote a lot of energy into the energy efficiency programs for the future. We would like to promote much more the energy efficiency in our buildings across the Europe. We are in discussions with the EIB, how to use better Juncker Investment Fund, and with the EBRD, how to promote the products they have already in the market, in a way that we can start kind of energy efficiency wave across the Europe. Because our building stock is outdated, the potential for energy savings are huge, and we just need to work with the well-motivated mayors, with the businessmen who want to invest in energy efficiency and offer them good solutions for the future. If you allow me to use my remaining time on COP21 and State of the Energy Union, which will be presented next week. I think that Fatih presented the picture very precisely. From one side, we should be encouraged because we have seen that now, I think, 156 countries already presented their INDCs. That we are actually covering more than 90% of the global emissions, and that we should be very much encouraged that 70% of additional electricity generation by 2030 would be the low carbon, and that we would continue this happy divorce or this decoupling between energy production, its low carbon part, and the GDP growth on the global scale. That's very positive, but at the same time, we also have to be aware that we are not going to hit the 2 degrees Celsius targets. We'll be still about that trajectory. And therefore, I think what would be very crucial for the Paris summit to call it a success, that it would be not end of the road, but it would be the summit about the new beginning of global responsible approach to the climate change, which would include the ambitious long-term direction, which would include the global stock-taking every 5 years, with the robust rules, with clear monitoring, with clear verification mechanism, and with adequate financial support. Only in that case we will be able, over the coming years, to make sure that we are getting on the trajectory which would keep us on the level which our scientists are telling us is the safe route and is the it's the safe way forward. On the Energy Union report, which I will present the next week, there we clearly want to make sure that this would become a regular event. That we spent a lot of discussions on how to do better macroeconomics in Europe in the spring, and I believe that we should devote at least part of our autumn political time to the energy union and to the energy transition and climate debate. We are going to present what we achieved already this year. We are going to outline the plans for the next year, which I call the year of delivery, because we want to put on the table 90% of what we promise we will do under the Energy Union umbrella already for the next year. Because we want our member states to see the whole picture and to start to work on their long-term strategies and on their national energy and climate plans, which would become a very important part of the robust European governance for the next year. So I just hope that as we regularly discuss the state of macroeconomy and economic developments in Europe, then in autumn we will be able to set the regular framework for discussing energy, climate, decarbonization of transport, progress in research and innovation, all five dimensions of the energy union. Once again, I really would like to thank the Friends of Presidency and Natalie for organizing this event, for sending me the kind invitation. I would like to thank Fatih for not only excellent report, but great cooperation, and for already his insight how much we can do together, and very much looking forward to that cooperation and to the discussion we are going to have. Thank you very much.
Mariusz, thank you. Mariusz, thank you very much. This effort also takes a lot of human energy, if I might say, and I think you've got it. You're having to drive this energy union for the European Union, and we look forward to hearing your energy state of energy union next week. If I might introduce our other panelists, Susana Quintana Plaza, Senior Vice President for Technology and Innovation at E.ON, that is Germany's biggest power utility in Germany. Giles Dixon, the new Chief Executive Officer of the European Wind Energy Association, and Eric Wernes, Chief Economist of Statoil, that is one of the that is of Norway, one of the largest oil companies in the world. Let's move to Eric. I've seen you say in recent interviews that you could see an oil price of $80 by 2018. That is a little bit different from what Fatih said. How is your sector adapting to this outlook, and how are you adapting to this carbon-free or low-carbon trend? You're going to be heavily affected by that, no?
Yes, we will. Thank you for inviting me. Thanks to IEA and Fatih for a job well done again. On the short-term price forecast for oil, I'll be very careful. I was not the one who said it was $80 in 2018, but that was some months back, and markets changed rapidly. I can disclose to you that our forecast for 2020, even some months back, is not very far away from what IEA just presented. And we're in the long-term business, so whether we hit that price forecast in 2018 or 2020 is probably a matter of coincidence and not being good or bad forecasters. I'll comment a little bit generally, and then I guess you'll see what we think about the low-carbon future towards the end of what I'm saying. But I think in a world of uncertainty and change, it's all like we always have, but it's good to have institutions that dare to take a long-term perspective, to focus on long-term developments. There are not that many institutions that do, but fortunately IEA does. When we look at the long-term energy market developments, we're required to think through what are the short-term changes that potentially have long-term effects, and what are the short-term changes that are just disturbances. And that's exactly what the World Energy Outlook tries to do. The global energy system is huge, and it's growing. Assets in the energy system have very long lives, so generally the system changes very slowly. And now we're in a situation where we have to make that change faster. We have to make the system change faster, otherwise we're in trouble. And that's a challenge for politicians, in particular, especially now just before Paris, but it's also a challenge for businesses and consumers who have to adapt to changing framework conditions that hopefully lead us in the right direction. And the scenarios that are presented in the World Energy Outlook, Fatih didn't spend much time on that. He presented basically the one of the scenarios, and in addition the low oil price scenario. But those scenarios in total illustrate possible futures going forward and possible ways, pathways to a more sustainable energy system. And we can agree on, we definitely disagree on the detailed components that will lead us in the right direction. But we all agree that we need to address a large set of factors. For instance, energy efficiency, critically important for sustainable development, to speed up the decoupling of global GDP growth from energy demand growth. We're talking about growth in low carbon sources of energy, particularly electricity. That's new renewables and nuclear. We're talking about decline in coal consumption. How do we get that to happen? If we don't, then the challenge in these other parameters becomes much, much, much more difficult. And we're talking about, at some point, developing carbon capture and storage solutions. That's basically the elements that we have to adjust. We have the same hope. We, as Statoil, oil company, we have the same hope for Paris as the IEA, as what Fatih just said. We also work with scenarios. As an oil company, we stand out as being the only one that publicly have presented a 2-degree scenario, very much in line with the 450 ppm scenario that IEA has presented over several years. And our scenario is called Renewal. And we now see that IEA's most recent update, both the low carbon scenario but also the new policy scenario, are very similar to ours. And a clear conclusion from IEA and us, which is also important to remind the audience about, is that oil and gas are here to stay for decades. If you look at the detailed projections in IEA's 2-degree scenario in this year's report, total oil and gas consumption in 2040 in the 2-degree world is only 6% below what it is today or what it was in 2013. That means that there's a huge need for investments in new oil and gas to 2040, even if the world goes in the right direction. So our challenge is clear and it's difficult. We must deliver a lot of new oil and gas while investing huge amounts of money and capital and resources in new sources of low-carbon energy. It's not either or. The world needs both.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Eric. Thank you. Let's move on to Giles Dixon of the European Wind Energy Association. You said in a recent interview that you've got to reach out to your allies and skeptics. We see from this report that renewables are a trend, a very important trend. Very interesting that renewables were 50% of the investment in power last year. How do you see this? Is it making this easier for your job?
Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. As Fatih has told us, renewables are no longer niche, they are mainstream. In Europe, wind now provides 10% of our electricity. And as wind has expanded, the costs have fallen by 30% in the last 5 years, and the costs, as the WEO tells us, will continue to fall through until 2040. If you build a new onshore wind farm in Europe today, it will cost you $83 per megawatt hour. That's the capex, the opex, and the cost of capital. The equivalent figures for coal and gas in Europe today are $105 for coal and $118 for gas. So onshore wind is the cheapest form of new power generation capacity in Europe today. Wind makes economic sense. Wind also brings wider economic benefits. The Vice President has told us 1.1 million people work in renewables in Europe. By our own conservative industry estimate, it's 262,000 in wind alone in Europe. For every euro invested in wind in Europe, the steel sector in Europe earns 12 euro cents, and the cement sector earns another 12 euro cents. And the value of Europe's renewables equipment exports, most of which are wind, is 35 billion euros to the European economy every year. As Fatih has explained, in the World Energy Outlook, we see the balance of the global energy system shifting away from fossil fuels. As we've heard, nearly half of investments in new power generation capacity last year were in renewables. Between now and 2040, 60% of the investments will be in renewables. That 60% is not just an aspiration. It is fully reflected in the INDC pledges that countries are making for Paris. Let's take a look. China, India, Brazil, Turkey all have very ambitious commitments for wind for 2030. And they have policies in place or are putting them in place to deliver on those commitments and targets. Smaller countries too, Ghana, Bangladesh, Tunisia, Mongolia, all have commitments for wind going up to 2030. 54 countries in total have mentioned wind in their INDCs, and these are commitments up to 2030. But when we come closer to home, ladies and gentlemen, the picture is a little different. Of the 28 EU member states, only four have clear commitments and policies in place for renewables beyond 2020. And this lack of long-term policy clarity and ambition on renewables is beginning to impact on investments. Some of you might have seen the recent Ernst & Young report. It said very clearly that Europe is now a less attractive place to invest in renewables than China, India, or the US. Now, as the Vice President has reminded us, the Commission is very clear. Europe should lead the world in renewables. As things currently stand, it's not clear at all that we're going to be able to do so. This will impact on our ability to deliver our climate targets, our energy security targets, and when you think onshore wind is the cheapest form of new power generation today, it will impact also on our competitiveness targets. But there's a wider industrial and economic policy risk that I want to highlight. The WEO says that the global market for renewables investments between now and 2040 is $8 trillion US dollars. Wind will be 35% of that. That means every year globally, $160 billion will be invested in wind. Now today, the European industry has a 50% share of that global market. And we have a 40% share even of the global market excluding the EU. So we're doing pretty well. Some of you might have seen Gamesa, their profits doubled this year on the back of big wind orders in India and China. But we are very concerned about the long-term future when Europe is falling behind the level of policy clarity and ambition for the period beyond 2020 that we are now seeing in other emerging and developing economies. Europe has established a strong wind industry. It's done so on the scale of the European market, thanks to the ambition we've had so far for the period up until 2020. That scale has given us a competitive advantage. If the level of policy ambition and clarity shifts to other countries, however, we will lose that competitive advantage. That will hurt us in terms of industrial policy, our economic and export performance, It will hurt us also in terms of how we meet our climate, energy security and competitiveness targets. So we call on the EU to give us strong, ambitious policies for how we deliver the renewables target of at least 27% by 2030, to give us the electricity market that will function for variable renewables and allow Europe to make its rightful contribution to the global ambition on renewables that Fatih has told us about. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Giles. Quite a challenge to the European Union, the EU28, and of course, Marouche will give you some time to respond to that. But let's first go to Susanna, and we'll also, of course, go out to you after we get some reaction from Fatih and from Marouche. Susanna, as part of E.ON, how is a huge utility like yours adapting to decarbonization? Now, what I've seen recently is that you've been really on a buying spree, investing in different startups, of late an American startup that with an app that helps consumers save energy. Can you give us a bit more about that?
Of course, thank you. First of all, thank you to Friends of Europe for inviting me to this panel, and thank you so much for such a very insightful global view of what the future energy market is. I was very happy to see that by the early 2030s, renewables will surpass coal as the largest form of energy. And, of course, the decoupling of the CO2 together with the energy consumption, that will be a great news for the future. But renewables have other implications. And the main implication that I want to highlight today, and that hopefully answers your question, is that renewables are changing large parts of the energy industry into a consumer good industry. Why do I say that? Let me give you an example. If you, until very recently, the energy was driven by conventional generation. Conventional generation, you needed billions to play in this game. If you didn't have billions, you were not part of this club. Why? Because a power plant costs you at least half a billion. It's a very complicated technology. You have to have very smart engineers behind these technologies. So only a few of us could play out there, no? Tens of us in Europe, let's say. What did wind do? Wind made the market accessible to anyone with millions. Also, it's a little complicated, but it's not such a complicated technology. So now we go with a market with 10 that have billions to a market of thousands that have millions. What does solar do? Well, solar makes everything energy accessible to anyone who has thousands. And at least in Europe, especially in Germany, there's quite a few people that have thousands. So now we have from 10 with billions to thousands with millions to millions with thousands. Now, let's look at these business models. I don't know how many of you are familiar, like Solar City, where you can lease a rooftop. Now, all you need is a credit history and a rooftop to become an energy producer. So we now have billions of people with zero who can be energy producers. So what are the implications of this? Our ability to predict capacities and decide on long-term investments for power plants are significantly reduced. Because I may put my power plant here because I know there's economic growth and development, but nobody's telling me that over the next 40 years, this neighborhood will not decide to all go solar. And who will give me my money back for this billion that I have put in the ground for the next 40 years? So the future is all about going into turning into a consumer good industry. To go into these consumers and giving them the tools and the capabilities to be energy producers. To steer these thousands, billions, or millions of players on their energy needs. And that's why we're investing in energy startups. That we're not only helping with energy efficiency to make energy more real for the consumers, we're also enabling them to become energy producers and prosumers with better tools. The Vice President was just mentioning to me a company that we are working on at E.ON, one of our investments, where this company is able to use similar technology to Google Maps and map an entire city and tell you specifically which rooftops depending on inclination, depending on shading, depending on location, are more suitable for PV. Now, an energy company like us can match that information together with consumption data. And we can tell you specifically how much you specifically will save if you will have PV in your rooftop. Add a battery to that. I don't believe consumers will become independent from the grid. But if you're 80% independent, that's a big hit for the traditional business model and a huge opportunity for whoever captures that market. So that's why at E.ON we have decided several things in the last year. One, we have divided the company in two. One part will take care of conventional generation because, as it was very well explained before, this is not going away. It's not going away yet. And if it goes away, the lights will go out. There's not enough renewables in the market yet to make this system sustainable. But the other part, the part of E.ON, will take care of renewable energy, wind and solar, will take care of this new smart distributed grid that consumes, that connects prosumers and connects consumers and connects industries. And of course, mostly we will focus on creating new solutions for the consumers as the one I just mentioned.
Susanna, thank you very much. Thank you. Let's go to some reaction first before we go out to you. Fatih, you've now heard from the utility sector, the renewable sector, from the oil and gas sector now, just now. What is your reaction to some of the challenges that you heard from them?
So I would prefer to hear also from the colleagues in the floor, but just perhaps therefore three very quick reactions. First of all, to Mr. Vice President. Now, I appreciate very much the idea of the energy union, and also I heard for the first time today that repeating it every year, it's an excellent idea. But the most I appreciated in Mr. Vice President's remarks is that he definitely sees the Europe in the context of global energy markets. It makes me very happy because Europe is not an energy island. Whatever happens around Europe will affect Europe, from energy prices to emissions, from emissions to investment trends, the cost of reduction of solar to other things. And I was very impressed and therefore thankful to Mr. Vice President putting the Europe in a global context. About the companies, I can, without any specific companies chosen, I think if there is any single energy company in the world, can be oil, gas, electricity, renewables, whatever, which believes that the climate policies will not affect their business strategies or profits, they are making a mistake. They are making a grave commercial mistake. I'm not talking about the moral issues and responsibility and so on. It is a business mistake if they believe that the climate policies will not affect their policies or businesses. Third point on the issue of the renewables. Now, renewables, especially solar and wind, they have a challenge, as many of us know, and some people repeat more than the others. It is the variability of the renewable sources, wind and solar, depending on the meteorological condition. This is a challenge for the renewable industry, but this challenge can be addressed through enhancing the grids, getting some definitely better integration of renewables in the system and with backup technologies. But the main challenge for the renewables is not the variability of the renewables themselves, but the variability of the policies supporting renewable energies. This is a big challenge, giving different signals, changing the signals, strength of the signals, and not being consistent, definitely not a good news for a sector which is relatively new compared to others, and investors may well be not getting these signals in the right way. So these are the three points I wanted to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Fatih. Let's go to Marouche. I mean, how you mentioned that this climate summit is going to be a beginning because as the commitments that Fatih has estimated, will still see a 2.7 degree increase in global temperatures. Now, some would say that this summit is going to be a failure then, if it does not have a plan that keeps it at two degrees or below. You see it as a new beginning. How do you, why is this not a failure?
No, I think that at first, if you want to qualify the success, you have to compare it with something comparable. And I think here, if we just look back, let's go back to Kyoto. There, I mean, the result of the Kyoto was that we had 35 countries who actually became the official parties to Kyoto Protocol, and they covered only 13% of the global emissions. Now, with this new approach, which I think is much more apt to the current developments, we are having 156 countries today, and I'm sure that in the end we will get all 196 parties, 195 countries and the EU to join this global effort. And I'm sure that we are already now covering more than 90% of the global emissions. And what is even more important for me, that all the key players are ready to play the game. They adopted their national contributions, these INDCs. They are setting up the long-term plans, how they want to achieve it. But we know that we are putting the new structure, new model, new framework within which we would work, but with the knowledge that it's not enough, that we still need to work very hard to actually make it to that safe trajectory. Therefore, the EU is such a big proponent of these two very key elements. The first one, that we need to have long-term goal. For us, it's 2050, where we would like to see the reduction of greenhouse gas emission between 40 to 70%, because we know that if we achieve that, we are getting on that healthy trajectory. Therefore, we are such a big supporter of having these regular get-togethers. Let's see every 5 years how we are doing. Do all the countries respecting their pledges? Do we have some free riders? Do we have some countries which might need help technically, financially, technologic-wise, to actually achieve the pledges they put on the table, and to gradually go to that level which would keep us on that longer-term healthy trajectory. And then I believe if we would have the key elements, longer-term view, ambitious result in Paris, but also that readiness to work together and to have the regular planning and strategizing of our common approach as a global community, then I think we can speak about the success in Paris. And then just the last thing what I would like to say here, that when we are looking at these long-term plans, we very often underestimate the technological progress. If we look today where we have been technologic-wise 15 years ago, let's look at our smartphones. We even didn't have an idea that things like that would exist. And what I see across the Europe, what kind of technology we are developing, what is being developed in the United States and elsewhere in the world, I'm very optimistic that we will see a lot of these, I would say, disruptive accelerators which would really accelerate this energy transition. Therefore, I was so pleased to hear about our technological age in Europe and how successful we are, not only in patenting it, but also exporting it outside of Europe. And that, I think, would be something what would be very important for the business planning for what I call companies of the future, which, as Susan said, would not be selling the energy. They've been selling the energy services. They've been supplying the solutions to our cities, become smart cities, and they will be working much more with the consumers and their concrete needs to actually make this energy transition interesting, not only for the big businesses or for entrepreneurs, but for the average consumers.
And Marouche, what about the challenge from Giles that Europe is falling behind?
I think that I'm very glad that he made that point, because I can quote him when I will see the energy ministers next week. Because what we are discussing right now is exactly what I believe
we need and we are currently missing in Europe. He's absolutely right that we have now only four member states who have the long-term view, how they want to transform their economies, how they want to frame the energy transitions in their member states. And I'm absolutely convinced that every member state, every state on this planet will have to go through this process of energy transition and economic transformation, because simply the climate changes here and you have to adapt or you suffer the terrible consequences. So we will have to do it. And, of course, the best way is if this effort is well planned, well prepared, when it's publicly debated and when you build the societal and public consensus around what you want to do. Therefore, next week, in the State of the Energy Union, we are going to propose the new template, how we in the Commission believe these new long-term plans for 2030 should be developed in every member state. What these national energy and climate plans should look like, how they should target all five dimensions on the energy union, because we believe that this is kind of giving the member states the ownership of that process. It triggers healthy debates within our member states, what we want to do, how we want to achieve, and it also gives us the possibility in the European Commission to compare the efforts, to see if the trends are well, and to really set the long-term framework, which are number one request I'm getting from all business community. We are ready for the energy transition, but we need regulatory stability, we need clear signals, and we need to make sure that you are not changing rules every 2 or 3 years. And this is something what we need to work on collectively, EU and the member states together.
Do we have any questions at this point? Yes. Can we get a microphone?
Thanks. Jean-Michel Glachon, Foreign School of Energy Regulation. The question is about European energy companies' future and business plan. A few days ago, maybe yesterday, E.ON did announce again a revision of assets value for 8 billion, maybe. Last week, 2 weeks ago, ExxonMobil is said to be sued for lying to investors regarding the value of energy assets. And surprisingly, Statoil has a personal view of the value of oil and then of the value of its assets. How should I think about it? How our politicians or analysts think about likely value of our energy companies and likely future for their business plans?
Can we get another question as well? Is anybody else? Yes, please.
Thank you. John Cooper, representing Fuels Europe, the European petroleum refining industry. We support global action to address climate change. As we've prepared, or as the world has prepared for COP21, we've heard multiple calls for placing a global price on carbon. That has come from Cristiana Figueres, it's come from multiple politicians, and it's also come from multiple international oil and gas companies. We know that that's not actually in the plan for this agreement this year, but the ambition still remains. So I'd like to ask Mr. Birrell in particular, but any of the panelists that would like to respond. First of all, what is the route to actually getting a global price of carbon implemented? Secondly, how should that price actually be decided? And thirdly, and quite importantly, what would we do with the funds? What's the right thing to do with the money raised from putting a price on carbon? Thank you.
Okay, global ETS, perhaps. Any other question? One more question. We'll take, we'll take three at a time. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning to all. Bernard Van Uyl from IOGP, International Association of Oil and Gas Producers. Thank you to Mr. Birrell and all the speakers for the valuable, much valuable presentation. The question I have highlighted one element in the Mr. Birrell presentation, the impacts of the low oil price, positive elements, but also some negative ones. And I will quote one of them, our reliance on Middle East oil will get back to the level of the 70s, and it will have a sharp market rebound by 2020. And Mr. Birrell highlighted this issue twice, coming back on the issue in its conclusion, mentioning there is no room for complacency. So my question to Mr. Stefkovic, regarding the EU policy, regarding taking into consideration this element of oil security, and also taking into consideration the low carbon intensity of hydrocarbon produced in the EU, is there no room in the energy union or in the EU policy in general for encouraging investment in oil and gas production in Europe? Thank you.
Okay, let me go to somebody else first. Eric, perhaps you might answer this, the question about energy assets and this route for a carbon price.
Yeah, on the valuation of different types of energy assets is always a difficult issue. It depends on the view that you have on future oil and gas prices, and in the case of utilities, the future electricity prices. And of course, what's happening at the moment is that the current oil and gas prices are lower than we tended to get used to over a three-year period of very stable and high oil and gas prices. They're at the moment roughly at the average of what it has been over the last 45 years. IEA's price forecasts indicate that, in all the scenarios, indicate that the current low, and Fatih said that too, I mean, prices at $50 for a long period is not sustainable. There's reason to believe that oil and gas prices will go up. I don't think we have seen the final set of regulations that we need in order to make our electricity system based on a lot of renewables work. They don't work at the moment. So we need, not even in Germany, which is very far and an advanced country. So there's a lot of regulatory work to do also to make those markets work. But so if you look at the forward markets, there's a strong need for growth in renewable energy. There is a strong need for keeping oil and gas production going at the current levels, even in a 2-degree world. And in order to make that happen, oil and gas prices will have to come up as well. So, and then when you evaluate companies, then you generally don't take much into account, because of discounting, you don't take into account the effects of what happens after 2030, basically. But of course, there will be oil and gas production there too, but it doesn't affect the values of the companies yet. So that's on the road to global carbon price. We have been arguing for a global carbon price. We are in a situation where we've been operating under the world's highest CO2 price since 1991 on the Norwegian continental shelf. If every country had that CO2 price at the moment, we probably would have a very different discussion here at the moment. Because the global carbon emissions would look very differently. How we can get there? It's probably going to be a gradual process. I don't think necessarily we need one price established as one ETS system or one tax or whatever. It's going to be a combination. I think we will see regional trading systems combined with border adjustment taxes to avoid carbon leakage. Once China gets its carbon trading system in place, I wouldn't be surprised if they also look at the opportunities for carbon for border adjustment taxes, and then you will see something that gradually develops in that direction. Combine that with direct regulations, which they tend to like more west of the Atlantic than east of the Atlantic, and that also drives an implicit price on carbon. And then at some point, we have a system which is almost global. The point is that we need to tighten the energy and climate policies addressing carbon emissions. The best way to do that is to put a price on carbon. How you do it is up for grabs, but I know we will need a combination.
Because at the moment, the carbon price is way too low.
Exactly. Also in Europe. It doesn't give the right incentives either. Yep.
Susanna, how does E.ON react, see this carbon price issue? I mean, that's going to impact you a lot. And at what point would the price of carbon have to come to justify or to rationalize carbon capture?
So, personally, I'm not a big believer in carbon capture. We have tried for many years, and it's not a technological issue. It's a consumer acceptance issue. People are very reluctant to have the carbon capture in their backyard. This is the non-in-my-backyard issue. On the carbon price, I definitely think we need very, very, very urgent action in this front. Today, Germany, despite the huge growth of renewables, CO2 emissions are going up. And they are going up because it's much cheaper to burn coal than to burn gas. E.ON, maybe going back to the assets question, has invested very heavily on very highly efficient gas plants, who will be key in the future to balance renewables. All those gas plants are out of the money. All the inefficient coal plants are on the money. So unless we solve the carbon issue, we will continue to emit CO2, because economically, unfortunately, it would make more sense for some to burn coal than more efficient technologies. So we definitely are in very urgent need of action.
Charles, on the carbon price, that would be quite decisive in your industry. What kind of global roadmap do you see for that that would help boost your industry?
Yes, of course, it's very important, and we shouldn't underestimate the impact of China's national ETS as and when it comes in. We've talked about China's ambition. The fact they're bringing in a nationwide ETS as early as 2017, and it will be the biggest in the world by some distance, reflects the overall level of ambition that they have on low carbon. In my own industry, in wind, China will overtake Europe next year in terms of the gigawatts of wind turbines that they have installed. They have a very strong industrial base now for making wind turbines. Sinovel, Goldwind are very serious global companies, important competitors of the European wind industry. They have started winning orders in Turkey. They are targeting markets in North Africa. They want to get into the European market. As of today, as you have said, Vice President, the European companies are holding their own. Our export performance is good. But if we do not have the strong and vibrant domestic market, then our export performance will suffer, and Europe will suffer economically as a result of that.
Can we take three more questions? We've got quite a few in the back. Let's go in the back now. I think this ETS issue is going to be quite decisive, I think, in the next few years.
Thank you, sir. Yes, sir. Stefan Singer, WWF International. Fatih, again, thanks for a valid, important, and informed report. I have a question to you. You showed that in your new policy scenario, which is your preferred scenario, which is a scenario, a projection is not a forecast. I think we need to keep that in mind, because it all depends on how the policies work. It could be stronger and better. This is just my comment. You said in your summary that overall investments in renewables, cumulatively, between now and 2040, will be only 15% of all energy supply investments. That is more, of course, than just the power market, where you showed us that 60% of the investments in the electricity market will go into renewables. So that leaves me with two questions to you. A, does only 15% of all renewables in the power supply market mean there's nothing going into renewables in the transport sector and in the heat sector and the industry sector? Is it just only electricity? And B, or is that a reflection of the radically decreasing renewable energy prices also projected by Bloomberg New Energy Finance a couple of weeks ago, showing that by 2030, 2035, wind, solar in particular, will be cheaper, levelized cost of electricity, in most regions of the world than coal and gas, even without a carbon price? On the other side, you could argue, if the price becomes so low, why then is the overall investment not higher? So I'm a little bit struggling with that one. Could you elaborate on that one? Thanks.
Please, the next question. Keep in mind, we got 15 minutes left. We got a hard ending at 12. So next question, please. Keep it brief, please.
Thank you. Tom Parmentier, I work as a policy and climate advisor at the Belgian Federal Parliament across the street. Mr. Warnes, you briefly touched upon carbon border taxes, which used to be on the policy agenda, but which has in recent years been pushed back on the agenda. What could we do to get carbon border taxes higher up the agenda again on the policy agenda? That's my first question. And another topic which has dropped off the agenda in recent years due to low oil prices are synthetic fuels. How could we get synthetic fuels back on the policy agenda? Thank you.
Okay, and one more question, please, back there.
Thank you. My name is Adam Bullock from the European Network of Transmission System Operators for Gas, shortly ENTSOG. So my question would focus on the European gas market. to Mr. Fatih Birol. So how do you see the shifts in the global LNG market and its implications on the global LNG price, and how would it influence the availability of the LNG on the European market? Thank you very much.
Okay, I guess let's go to Fatih. You've got a couple of the first and third questions were directed at you.
Thank you. If I may first say something very briefly about carbon prices. Now, carbon prices is, in my view, an incredibly important instrument to reduce the emissions in an efficient way, number one. Number two, I know that many oil companies, many colleagues, different corners, push the carbon price to be agreed in Paris. It's also very good. But the devil is in details, as I said, in these things. First of all, it would be only a welcome surprise if there is an agreement on a carbon price in Paris. I know this, and many people know about this, and therefore, to push the carbon price as the one and only expected outcome from Paris may not be the most effective policy. There are other instruments which can help us to reduce the emissions. Carbon price gradually will come in the picture. Of course, we have an excellent example in Europe. China, as Eric mentioned, coming through. In the US, we have some. But carbon price is not the only instrument. And when we look at the realistic picture today, I will be, as I said, it will be a welcome surprise for me if there is an agreement in Paris on carbon price. The second question is from Mr. Singer. First of all, today, because of the time, I talk about our central scenario, and it is not at all my preferred scenario. It is the central scenario. It is the reason I talk about that. Let me put that first. And second, bulk of the renewable investments, of course, go to electricity generation. This is normal, and 60% of the money, all money put in the power sector, come from the renewables. Very good news. But when we come to two other sectors, namely transportation, using biofuels, for example, or other options, or in terms of heating, to using renewable energy is definitely not as strong as power sector now. And these numbers I show you is our central scenario, which does not incorporate a major climate agreement. If there was a climate agreement in Paris, gives a signal to investors, this 60% will be higher in the power sector, and also we would see the impact on the other sectors, transportation and heat. Finally, on LNG, and I stop here, as I said, we are expecting to see more LNG in the markets. There is a new wave of LNG exporters. Australia, big push coming from Australia, United States, followed by Tanzania, Mozambique from Africa. And I really hope that the Europe makes the most out of it, mainly to create competition in the European gas markets, and at the same time to provide diversification for Europe's gas security. I know that Mr. Vice President and his colleagues are making a lot of efforts in that direction. I think this is definitely going in the right direction. When it comes to prices, we have seen the LNG prices going down. It's a very good time to act, in my view. And I wouldn't commit myself that the LNG prices will remain so many, many years to come. But currently, we have a low LNG price environment. I think it is time to make the most out of it. One more time, and I stop here. Also, the differences between the different regions in the gas prices are now narrower compared to 2 years ago.
Thank you, Fatih. Maruš, you had a couple of comments.
Just to link a little bit the ETS price of energy and reaction to Fatih's comments on LNG. The fact is that if it comes to the emission trading system, that we've been pioneers in Europe. We tried it on a large scale for the first time. All EU member states been working on the ETS. I think it brought us a lot of experience, a lot of positive results. But at the same time, we also have to admit that we didn't get all the entry parameters right. Because the carbon price today is very low, therefore we at first had to adopt this market stability reserve, meaning that we are going to take away 800 million allowances from the market and put it, as I like to say, to the very, very deep freezer. And we are already also presented the proposal how we are going to factor our new climate goals for 2030 to be properly reflected for the ETS system after 2020. And I have to say that this system has a lot of appeal also to our international partners. We are currently working very closely with China, offering them also the technical assistance. I know that they are testing it in this pilot phase in several places, and I think that before the end of this decade, they will start their own ETS, which I think would be very, very important breakthrough. I talk about it with the Quebec government and the Quebec Prime Minister, who have something similar in place, but they introduce also this floor and a cap element, so they have a little bit more predictable what the price of the carbon would be in Quebec. Ontario is going to join the next year. They are already in a joint system with California. ETS is working in South Korea. So I think that if China joins in and if our ETS is properly reformed, we would see something like more and more of the interconnection between the ETS systems, hopefully setting, you know, the precedence for eventual global solution. But I think it would be a gradual approach, because as in the EU, when you talk about the taxes, finance ministers are getting very, very edgy, and therefore we need to find the market-based mechanisms which would set the correct price for the carbon, but with the proper parameters. And this is what we need to do now in Europe, and this is where we need to work together with our global partners. When I asked the Quebec Prime Minister, because I think there the carbon price, I think, is around 20, 25 Canadian dollars, if I remember correctly, for ton, and I asked him how the industry is reacting to this. So he told me, of course, the industry is complaining, but at the same time, they are realizing that they have very good energy prices. And that's a little bit different with our European industries, because they're complaining that our energy prices are high. And they are right, because if you compare how much our industry and our consumers are paying for electricity or gas, so it's twice or three times more than how much they pay in the United States or Canada. And at the same time, we are then in this very paradoxical situation that our wholesale prices are so low that the energy sector says that it's very difficult to invest, but our end-user prices are very high. So I think we need to have a very honest debate in Europe. What is the reason for that? What we have, I would say, in between, and we want to contribute to this debate by presentation, and there I think we can work very closely with Fatih and with Eurostat to make sure that we would prepare such a comparable analysis. What is the cost price energy structure in Europe? Why? What we all put, I would say, in our energy prices? Should it be there, or should we look for other places in the national budgets to cover some of these revenues? Because then I think it would again move our energy and climate debate into another stage. What is the energy related? What are the real energy costs? What are the subsidies? What are the distribution costs? What are the different local fees, and so on and so forth? Because I think that we need to look the good balance between the fair competitive energy prices and, of course, the adequate price for carbon, so we can actually drive the innovation and this new solution for the future. And on the LNG, I'm in total agreement with Fatih. In Europe, we need to diversify. We are big energy importer, so I think deserve the fair treatment. We deserve the competitive price. We need to diversify our sources of energy, and therefore we are going to present LNG strategy in the February of the next year, just simply to look better how we can complement our energy mix in Europe by the new global community which is the LNG and which is here to stay and which I believe will be a very competitive factor in any future energy mix. Thank you.
Thank you, Marius. I'm so sorry we're running out of time at this point. We have to have a hard ending here at 12 o'clock. Before I invite you to lunch, a couple of points. I think what quite interesting that Fatih mentioning that the climate summit will have to give a signal to investors as well as those who are worried about the environment, but the investors in different sectors so they can plan ahead and try to cut CO2. Our thanks to all of the panelists, to Susanna, to Marouche, to Fatih, to Giles, and to Eric. Thank you to all of you. Thank you to Friends of Europe. Also keep in mind that Friends of Europe has done a number of analyses. If you go online to friendsofeurope.org, they have done a report, Europe's Energy Union and the Road to Paris and Beyond. That's something to read before Paris. So thanks to all of you for joining us, and see you next time.